Regular listeners know that I am interested in our ongoing re-examination of history, our reflection on who we are today through how we have defined ourselves in the past. I am Suzanne Lang with a novel idea. The Spanish-American War, the Filipino-American War, represent our country's initial emergence as an international presence to be reckoned with. These engagements may seem distant and characterized flatly through the yellowed lens of history, but these American takings set a path of meddling for our own gain, of taking sides in civil conflicts that defines us to this very day. Domestically, in the post-Reconstruction era in the late 1800s that ran up into the 20th century, lynchings were at an all-time high. And in this, too, we can trace our current cultural moment right back to Jim Crow. And it was in this climate that the Buffalo Soldiers, the African-American soldiers who patrolled the expanding western frontier of our country, breaking strikes, capturing cattle rustlers, and containing the Native Americans, were deployed abroad, first to Cuba and then to the Philippines. This is the context of Michael Morey's work, Fagan, an African-American renegade in the Philippine-American War. Morey unpacks America's imperialism, the bumpy trajectory of the post-colonial Philippines, and the racism that drove David Fagan to defect from the American military and become a guerrilla fighter alongside his fellow brown-skinned people in the Philippines. Michael Morey spent over 10 years puzzling through the limited source material on Fagan by visiting the Philippines and diving deep into archives, birth records, military documentation, and memoirs and biographies of Fagan's more documented cohort. Reading this book was truly like peering through the looking glass and discovering the roots of who we are today. Here is our conversation together. Michael Morey, welcome here today to talk about your just-released book, Fagan, an African-American renegade in the Philippine-American War. This is a book, and the title itself gives us a lot of clues what is at the heart of the book. The character of David Fagan, who was a Buffalo soldier in the United States Army, who was eventually deployed to the Philippines. And while there, he changes sides and becomes a guerrilla fighter. And in fact, rises through their military ranks. But throughout the book, Fagan is like a spectral force in a way, because you do a lot of research on him, but there's so much of him that is still very unclear to us. So you build this character, but around him is this incredible point in history, in American history, and in Filipino history that radiates today. And to read this book today, when that country continues to have a legacy of violence and brutality, and some might say in our country right now, we're experiencing a resurgence of racial tension and, in fact, some of the same divisions that have been with us for so long. And so I ask you, what was the genesis of focusing on David Fagan and his story and your long 10-year quest to tell it?
Well, exactly that. Fagan was the perfect vehicle to be able to talk about all these issues. Race in America at the advent of the Jim Crow era in 1900, and as well as when America went abroad and took our racial views with us, which has really negatively affected our relations with the developing world ever since. Fagan, to me, was the perfect example of what Du Bois talked about when he talked about the challenge of being both what he called a Negro and an American at the same time. He saw these two sort of conflicting identities in one warring body, and the goal was to keep from being torn asunder. And when we sent the Buffalo Soldiers to the Philippines, basically to do the white Americans' dirty work, to suppress another dark-skinned people's quest for independence, it caused just tremendous ambivalence among the Buffalo Soldiers there, as their letters attest. And about 15 of them, we don't know for sure, went over to the other side to join the Filipino revolutionaries. And David Fagan was by far and away the most successful and the most elusive, and became quite a celebrity in America.
Almost a mythological figure who seemed to taunt and terrorize his former American fellow soldiers. And in fact, even his very death is somewhat mysterious and unknown.
There were, I would say, three things that I was basically trying to do. First was to really go through and find out about his military record, because so much had been suppressed. And there were even questions by some historians sense that maybe his reputation was completely overblown, that he was more a mythic figure created by journalists with their wonderful imaginations. The other was to try to figure out as much as I could just who he was, what he was like, his personality, the nature of his grievances, his attitude about these things, to get an idea of the person himself. And lastly, as you suggest, there was a tremendous controversy over his death, supposed death, in December 1st, 1901. Especially in the last 50 years, more and more people have begun to speculate that he faked his death and lived on. And I think in the book here, no one had offered any evidence to support that, but it made sense because of the flimsiness of the military's report, the way they titled it, The Supposed Death of David Fagan, and then closed it out very quickly. I think that I've been able to at least make a pretty persuasive case that he lived on for some years, at least 4.5 years, and possibly longer.
I want to set up the story, but I want to follow up quickly with something you just said about perhaps some of the actual story of incidents that happened that involved David Fagan. You used the term suppressed. And in fact, in the book, you do intimate or suggest that perhaps information was not included in the official military record to reveal more about David Fagan. And so what gave you that idea?
Well, we could confirm through newspaper reports and other means, autobiographies of actions in which he led. And yet, when you look at the military reports, he's not mentioned. And in some cases, like in one telegram, that's where you found so much, is when the telegrams were sent right after perhaps an action in the field. In one case, the officers inserted a clause in a line The colored insurgent promises to take no more prisoners. I found that hand scrawled on a telegram, and it was slipped in very neatly, and it was a way for this officer to tell General Funston about the colored insurgent without really letting on. And then when you read the actual reports by the officers, there's no mention of Fagan, whereas I was able to confirm in three or four other different sources that he did in fact lead this ambush of 20 men from his former company. That happened repeatedly you could see things that were left out. His name was left out of reports, but then I could find evidence of that he was leading them these attacks elsewhere.
Do you have a notion as to whether that was just an artifact of being at war or some sort of intentional desire to not let on that an American soldier, even a black American soldier, was fighting for the enemy?
Well, for some reason, so many of the communications at the higher level have been lost. We have field reports and telegrams, but so many of the communications, and it's never been explained, but they were not kept. And that was certainly one suspicion, that there may have been some kind of official policy. And on the other hand, I think that you could just see throughout when you were going through all the evidence in the archives and elsewhere, when I knew that he had been places and involved in ambushes and assaults, that his name had been deleted. And how much it was official policy stated, I think it was because they didn't want Fagan to encourage other soldiers to desert. So I think they wanted to play down that his success in the field. And I think that had a lot to do with it. And there was a general censorship through the first 8 months or so of the war in general to keep the press from sending word of some of the really ugly things that were happening home to America.
And there were a lot of really ugly things happening over there in the Philippines. And let's set the stage here. David Fagan, young black man, grew up in Tampa, Florida, at a time when, you know, this kind of post-Reconstruction era that was a very charged time racially. And Tampa in particular, the site of many, many lynchings. And this is a time also when America is in what we might call an imperialist phase. We're in the period of the Spanish-American War, which leads then into the whole thing in the Philippines. We are going through the annexation of Hawaii, and that is some of the larger scene that's going on within this domestic scene of intense racial tension.
Yes. Undersecretary of the Navy Roosevelt and Senator Henry Cabot Lodge, Admiral Mahan, and Cabinet Secretary Elihu Root, and I think President William McKinley had really devised this grand plan for America to set forth upon the global stage. And it involved taking over control of the Caribbean, building an Isthmian canal, if I can say that word right, through either Panama or Nicaragua, taking Hawaii on as a territory. They took over the uninhabited island of Wake, and then the object was to take Guam, and then the Philippines. The reason is they needed coaling stations to keep ships going, so they had to have them interspersed. And the idea was also to take the city of Manila, which gave them access to China with this open-door policy towards China. And they, in fact, did this over the next 5 or 6 years. This was the greatest expansion in American history abroad, and it was when we asserted ourselves upon the global stage. And we did this at the expense of the sort of faltering Spanish Empire. These were the last possessions of the once vast Spanish Empire, Philippines, Cuba, and Puerto Rico. So as their empire fell apart, we just assumed their place, and We did this at the expense of the independence movements in both Cuba and in the Philippines. And so we frustrated their ambitions while fulfilling ours.
And the Buffalo Soldiers were battalions of black soldiers who did tours of duty in the West at the time and then were called to Cuba, and where many of them fell to yellow fever, and then were deployed over to the Philippines. Still quite a minority and led by white commanders.
Always. Yeah, there were four regiments of African-American regulars under white officers, most of them probably from the South, some of them deeply racist. They had been out on the Western Plains, everywhere from the Canadian border to the Rio Grande, since right after the Civil War. They had become sort of mythic figures even then by the time they arrived in Tampa, which was the staging ground for going to Cuba in July of 1898. And yes, they were really rugged fellows, great horsemen, and quite surprising for the poor blacks of Tampa who were, as they said, lived in dread at all times, to see these men who were not cowed at all by the white people refuse to step off the sidewalks, insist upon eating in cafes and drinking in the saloons. And this was just shocking to the Southern whites. And this conflict certainly helped bring on the Jim Crow era, because whites just found it intolerable to see black men in uniform and armed. And their independent behavior and refusal to keep their place, as they said, really helped bring on the really extreme racism in the South. Yeah,
and it was equally difficult for the Buffalo Soldiers to take treatment when they had been doing the work of America. They'd been serving a mission to this country, and in fact, so many of them then re-upped with the service.
Yes, they were deeply conflicted, because they thought by proving their loyalty, and even if they had to lay down their lives in the war, that it would help the lot of African-Americans at home. And what they were seeing and said was conditions for African-Americans just getting worse in the South. And then the doctrines of the extreme racist at this time began to take hold in the North as well. And they initially were noted for their heroism in the fight at San Juan Hill and El Caney, taking a fortress at the top of the hill. For some weeks, they were lauded as real heroes. And then the Southern press began to slander them in papers and in articles. And even Teddy Roosevelt, after praising them, then spoke disparagingly of them and betrayed them, really. And so there was a lot of bitterness by the time they went to the Philippines. And then to have to suppress their Filipinos' ambitions for independence became just intolerable for some of them.
The Filipinos, being a dark-skinned people who were called niggers by the white Americans.
Yes.
And this is where David Fagan is surrounded by this once he's deployed over there. And the record shows, and your diligent research shows, that David Fagan is increasingly harassed and disciplined and fined and subjugated to hard labor by his white commander. And this is most likely what maybe either politicized or just so moved David Fagan to turn over to the other side that he could maybe feel more aligned with.
Yes, it's hard to say the extent to which he was identifying in that political sense with the Filipino revolutionaries, how much his own really bitter dispute with his commanding officer, Lieutenant James Alfred Moss, who was a Southerner from Louisiana. And it's even reported that he fell in love with the Filipina, and that may have been a factor in it as well. But the fact that he remained loyal through a year and a half of fighting, absolutely loyal to the revolution, suggests that he really had a commitment to the revolution beyond just wanting to get back at the treatment he had received at the hands of white officers. There was a mix of those things, and that was one of the real challenges, was trying to understand his thinking, because he left nothing in writing. And so many of the people who might have told us more about him either didn't leave very much in terms of writing, and others died really young. And so it made it that much harder trying to get a fix on him. He was clearly a very flamboyant character. He was a lively fellow, very talkative, very voluble. Even in battle, he would taunt the Americans. He challenged General Funston to a duel during a fight. He was a master at stud poker. He was a very charming fellow, apparently, and amusing at times. We know all these things about him, so you get some sense of him, but it's not the same as sitting down with him and having a conversation and asking him just where he stood on all of these issues, which just has to remain unknown, I suspect.
You describe him, really, I'd say, at several points in the book, you use the term trickster, and which is a surprising term for somebody who also was exhibited a lot of brutality. But why don't you tell us why you characterize him as a trickster?
Well, every peasant culture all over the world has the trickster myths. And certainly David Fagan grew up in the Florida world, where the trickster myths were part of the lore, both West Indian and Southern lore. And what the trickster do is how a weak person, a person in a weak position, can stand up against the powerful. And they have every kind of methods. You know, if you can't directly confront them, because in the case of, say, the slaves, or during the Jim Crow era, the post-Civil War era, you could use dissimulation, you can pretend, feign ignorance, use arson, steal, use sabotage. You could even assassinate the slave master if you had a chance, because there's no real social contract here, so you're not part of any bargain. And so David Fagan, I think, used those techniques as well, and he had that impish sense of humor. I mean, he liked to fight with his wit, and he enjoyed taunting or mocking his enemies, as well as he really was a tremendous fighter. So, the trickster myth is really important in the Philippine culture as well. And I think the men would have understood him, the Filipino fighters under him, who revered him, and even called him General Fagan when he was a captain. I think they would have seen him also in the trickster terms. And there also, the other term that was popular, particularly in the 1890s, is the bad man theory. The bad man is basically the supernatural trickster, and it's both menacing and at times witty. And so that's a trope, but at Fagan, there's nothing to think that he ever thought of himself as a bad man or a trickster, but others put that label on him at the time. Both African Americans and whites referred to him as a bad man, and always they respected him as a fighter, but they also added their superstitious notions to him, that he had the supernatural powers as well.
And what he brought to these Filipino guerrilla fighters was, if not a sense of discipline, a sense of tactics that he perhaps had learned through being an effective soldier, and whose tactical talent was suppressed merely because he was a black soldier in a white structure. But he did provide more training and tactical information that made some of these raids or battles more effective for those Filipino guerrilla fighters.
Yeah, absolutely. He was in a region of East Central Luzon called Nueva Ecija, and the fighting there was not as severe, as extreme as it later became in other parts of the Philippines. But to the extent that they mounted a real challenge there, the Filipino guerrillas, Fagan was involved in almost every major, virtually every one, that took place there over a year and a half. He was designing them and leading them. So I think so often that happens that a young pupil, he was only 20 years old and then 21 when he was leading these fights, I think they're overlooked. His officers called him a good-for-nothing whelp. He also, he was unruly. He used foul language and slang, and I think they underestimated him. So they thought he wasn't learning very much, but it's pretty clear that he was a very bright fellow, and I think he was picking up a whole lot more than they imagined, and it's clear from the fights that he arranged as far as designing trenches and rifle pits, setting up ambushes. He was absolutely brilliant at these things. And how much of that came from training and how much that came from his own natural instincts, because he was just apparently very, very bright.
I'm talking with Michael Mori, the author of Fagan, an African-American renegade in the Philippine-American War. And there is so much to talk about here. I am Suzanne Lang, and this is KRCB's A Novel Idea. Let's take a short break with Bob Marley and the Wailers and what Michael Mori tells me is the theme song of his book, Buffalo Soldiers. Stay with us.
Buffalo soldier, dreadlock rasta. It was a buffalo soldier in the heart of America, stolen from Africa. Survival. I mean it when I analyze the stench.
I am Suzanne Lang with A Novel Idea. We're talking with Michael Morey on his book, Fagin, An African-American Renegade in the Philippine-American War. The author and independent historian describes the geography of the Philippines, the seasons, the rain, the mud and the mountains, as he sets us in the midst of this steamy place. He is colorful as he animates David Fagin, the black soldier who joined the Filipino guerrillas and became one of their military leaders. But Fagin is just one of the many people Morey explores to bring us well into the situation. Here is the rest of my conversation with Michael Morey. We are talking about David Fagin, who is the thread that cinches this whole story together that you're telling. But there are a lot of other characters in this book that are people in American history, people in Filipino history that we come to see as well. And though you talk about McKinley somewhat, I kind of feel that he's always hovering there in the background and that his policies were kind of setting a foundation for everything that was happening. And you have Teddy Roosevelt out there in the wings, too. But then you have these other people. You have Arthur MacArthur. You have Funston, who, in fact, our Fort Funston is named after. Funston plays a big role, and in some ways, Fagin is his nemesis. And there are other characters as well who you use as source material, but they bring a lot of color to the story, but also a lot of context.
Yeah, McKinley is fascinating. There's still a complete a real debate about whether he was just this amiable fellow being manipulated by Roosevelt and Lodge and others, or whether he was really the mastermind of all this, because he is known as our most mercurial and indecipherable president, inscrutable. He was just a master at playing his cards close to the vest and getting what he wanted. But there's quite a difference of opinion as to how much what his role was. But Teddy Roosevelt actually only came in as president after the war was in its late stages in September of 1901. And already the war had been lost in northern Luzon in David Fagin's area, and he'd been outcast. Other figures are like Aguinaldo, whom a lot of Americans know that name. He was the president, and unfortunately, he was a very incompetent leader, and he did not help the revolutionaries at all. And then there was the fellow who's, to me, is the most remarkable figure of the era, is Apolinario Mabini, who was considered the brains of the outfit. He was paralyzed by infantile paralysis when he was 32, and he was a man with just the most amazing icy intellect. He was noted to not have much of a sense of humor, but had such a razor-sharp intellect that he really threatened the Filipino elite, because though they were fighting for their independence, it was going to be a very top-down thing, more an oligarchy, really. Yeah, and then Frederick Funston is just a fabulous character. I don't think there's been few more colorful or controversial characters ever to parade across the American stage. And I had, sadly, to leave so much out about both Mabini and Funston to adhere to the real story of Fagin. But Funston was just he was a very tiny fellow, about 5'4", a little over 100 pounds, and he probably suffered from the usual small man's complex, and he overcompensated in a way that was just amazing. He ended up capturing Aguinaldo, the president, by a ruse, and That's and therefore he became what I think the name that's most remembered and associated with the war. But he could not capture David Fagan, and it drove him up the walls. Fagan had so aggravated him when he challenged him to a duel in a fight that he made it clear that if anybody in his among his six regiments that were under him that got rid of Fagan or killed him would stand very high in his esteem. And so, yeah, he's a fabulous character. And people always ask me when they read the book or hear the story, they got to make a movie of this. And I Funston would be a lot of fun for some actor.
I, too, as I was reading this, thought, yes, this would make an incredible movie. And even though the character of David Fagan is somewhat, there's a lot of gaps, there's also the reminiscences of people that there were passages in the book where I felt like I was looking up at him and watching him laugh as he was, maybe had the barrel of a gun pointed down. And so you really do create, even though there's, I want to say, not a lot of robust firsthand information, you create a rather graphic character at the center of this. And Funston and some of the peripheral characters as well are very easy to picture and see what their characters like. I was equally intrigued, though, or throughout the book, with seeing that this brutality on both sides is the brutality of war, but also one of domination, of disrespect. And sometimes even I think the American soldiers just didn't even know what it was all about. Like, what were they even doing there? Which I think has been symptomatic of many of the wars and conflicts our country has been involved with since. And the Philippines has, David Fagan is at the heart of their history in the 20th and 21st century as well, which is defined also by inner conflict and violence and brutality. Right now in the Philippines, there's a leader who out loud says, yeah, we can assassinate people. And so I found that intriguing, that through this book, we really can see the lineage of both of our countries.
Yeah, the Americans, in setting up the American regime starting in 1901 or 1902, did nothing to, in terms of nation building, did nothing for the vast majority of peasants, called the Tao, the farmer. They allowed the Filipino elite, known as the Principalia, those who were the business people and the owners of the land, and then the Ilustrados were considered the enlightened, the educated elite. They allowed them to just go ahead and establish an oligarchy, basically, and we completely supported that. And so you've had dynastic rule of families or clans ever since. The vast majority of Filipinos have remained in a kind of renter status. They haven't been given a true ownership in their land. Control has always been among these handfuls of families who, in the Machiavellian sense, fight very viciously with each other for control. So Duterte is, I'm not that familiar with more recent Philippine history other than the EDSA movement under Cory Aquino, when it seemed as if they were going to really make some substantive changes. But again, Cory Aquino's family was the largest landowner in the country, and not a bit of their land went over to to land reform. So the Filipino peasants have always, and this is unfortunate legacy of America's involvement there, they have remained impoverished and suffered so much injustice, and we abetted this. We allowed it to happen. Duterte's kind of interesting only in that he is thumbing his nose at America and making friends with China. America's just always assumed they could keep control of the Philippines. It's a really complex history, and so I wanted to raise the issue. And, of course, the counterinsurgency war was so similar in many respects to the war in Vietnam and then to our current conflicts, the one in Iraq and then in Afghanistan. These have all been disastrous for America. And even though we prevailed in the Philippines, we presided over the deaths of as many as 500,000 of them, 24,000 certainly in warfare, and 4,200 Americans died, just as almost the same number that died in Iraq. They're very similar, these two wars. So I wanted to bring attention to those. For more recent history, something like Police in the Empire by Alfred McCoy is a great book covering the whole history of the Philippines through the 20th century and up to the present.
And then we have our own domestic legacy that I think we definitely see the tethers to that time and some of the racial issues that we sometimes think we're addressing, and then we find out there's still a lot of racial judgment and derision and animosity.
Yeah, I think if to try to understand our ongoing racial problems, it's really good to go back and look at this period when the fortunes of African Americans were already very grim, but then they got a whole lot worse there for a whole variety of reasons. In the late 90s, we had the Plessy versus Ferguson ruling that allowed separate but equal accommodations. We had the disenfranchisement of African Americans that began in 1890 in Mississippi and ended in 1900 with North Carolina, when blacks were denied the vote throughout the whole South. And the phenomenon of lynching peaked in the 1890s. A lot of this comes from this idea of last place aversion. The poor whites in the South, particularly the sharecroppers and others, could not stand the idea that they might be passed up by blacks, because a number of African Americans were actually being successful, achieving success despite all these obstacles. And a number of them were lynched, not because they had done something that was perceived as bad, but because they were being successful. So the Southern whites were determined in this kind of crazy reactionary attitude to keep blacks forever subservient in a kind of permanent caste system, and to preserve the plantation and mine system in the South, to keep blacks forever working in the cotton fields, as if you could just stop time. It's so crazy. But the lynchings were these diabolical rituals that went on. There was nothing even worse in the Middle Ages than entire town, children, everyone would come and celebrate the prolonged torture and usually the burning of African Americans. So that mentality is, the residue of it is far from gone. It's still there in people. Back in 1900, the great Filipino novelist Jose Rizal said, America is the land par excellence for freedom, but only for white people. And certainly, all through the first half of the, up through to the Civil Rights Act and Voters' Rights Act, all through the first two-thirds of the 20th century, there was a hierarchy in America in terms of race, class, and ethnicity, with black people on the very bottom and whites perceiving themselves always at the very top. And this perception is still very much alive among so many in America. So that's why this, to me, is really important to step back and take the longer view this issue.
I'm speaking with Michael Morey. The book is Fagan, an African-American renegade in the Philippine-American War. And I want to talk with you about the writing of this book, which is so heavily researched. You've traveled to the Philippines, and it took you a long time to write. And so let's talk a little bit about that process, about how did you start, when did you know you had a story, and so forth.
Well, when I wanted to read about what was then called the Philippine Insurrection, I found Leon Wolf's Little Brown Brother was published in 1960. There are very few histories about the Philippine-American War. And as I was reading, I came across this passage about an enormous Negro named Fagan, deserted, joined the what were then called the insurrectos, and that he drank heavily, caroused, married a Filipina, played guitar, and fought like a wildcat. And I was just instantly intrigued. I thought, who is this guy? And when I looked, tried to look further into it, I could find almost nothing about him. And I've always identified in a way with the outcast or the people on the bottom. I get tired of histories that are always just about the generals and the politicians. You would think that the only thing that mattered about that era was Teddy Roosevelt and his Rough Riders charged up San Juan Hill, and now we move on to World War I. And I liked the idea of trying to tell the story more from the bottom up. And again, I was very interested in this idea of a conflict of loyalties that happens, because it certainly happened during the Vietnam era, when a lot of people thought that as a loyal Americans, their true responsibility was to resist the war, to oppose it. And then, of course, you were called a traitor. And that's what happened at the time of the Philippines. You had a very vocal anti-war movement, and then you had an administration that cast anybody who criticized the war as a traitor. So these things keep happening. So that fascinated me. And then as I thought, well, perhaps some African-American historian will write a book about Fagan. But as the years went by, and I saw nothing really about him, and I had picked up a degree in history at Sonoma State, and that's when I started just thinking about it. And I decided my attempts at writing fiction were getting nowhere. And I thought, well, I'll just try a different tack. And once I got started, I was just so intrigued, because it's like detective work, the sleuthing. Working in the National Archives is very difficult, but it can be incredibly rewarding when you hit on something. You're searching for all these needles in various haystacks. But as you put them together, I mean, my feeling about it is what I finally got was about a jigsaw puzzle portrait of Fagan that's about two-thirds done. I don't think that I fully brought him as vividly to life as I could, but that's as far as I could go with the paucity of evidence that was out there.
And you, as the writer, generally in the book, you let us know when you were sketching him based on limited knowledge. And in fact, I was interested in some of your choices in writing the book, because much of the book where you're telling the story, I mean, you, the author, are telling the story, and we are brought into the story kind of outside of who you are. But there are very many parts of the book also where suddenly you reflect on, you know, I just couldn't find anything out more about this, or when you might have been surprised something. And those little passages where, oh, yes, there's a person at the back of this who is reflecting on it as I, the reader, am. So what about some of those choices?
There's a great historian, Paul Kramer, who teaches at Vanderbilt. And he's written extensively Blood of Government, which is about the Philippines and race in American history. And he went over the manuscript. It was fantastic. And he encouraged me to introduce myself into the book. I didn't think historians should do that. You know, there shouldn't be any reference to I in there. But he said, no, you take the reader along on your search here. And his idea was that since so much of this can't be nailed down for sure, that we work from a position of informed speculation. And he uses that in the nice blurb he gave in the back, that expression. And so he encouraged me to take that approach and to sort of reach out to the reader and let them know when I wasn't really sure, but this is what I think, and inviting them to, you know, reach their own conclusion on the basis of as much evidence as I was able to present.
And I think you've done that, because there were times, I have to say, that I sometimes questioned you as the author. So that really does create a dialogue with the reader. And to me, that's a successful place to be as a writer.
Well, thank you very much. It helped me to, with Professor Kramer's encouragement to take that approach and to go ahead and step in there now and then. And I think it worked.
I think so, too. Mm-hmm. Michael Morey, I want to thank you for bringing this to us, and congratulations. It seems like it has been a long time coming for you, a lot of research, a lot of years, and here it is, a fine book, Fagan, an African-American Renegade in the Philippine-American War. Thank you so much.
You're very welcome.
We've been talking with Michael Morey on Fagan, an African-American Renegade in the Philippine-American War, a publication of the University of Wisconsin Press. University of Wisconsin publishes a range of general interest books, scholarly publications, and books of regional interest, as well as a range of journals expressing our local and global cultures. Let's listen to a bit of Nina Simone before we go out. This is Backlash.
My wages and send my son to Vietnam. You give me second-class houses and second-class schools. Do you think that all colored folks are just second-class fools, Mr. Backlash? I'm gonna leave you with a backlash blue. Backlash. I'm gonna leave you with a backlash blue. Mr. Backlash, just what do you think I got to lose? I'm gonna leave you with the backlash blues. You're the one who'll have the blues, not me. Just wait and see.
Nina Simone. I am Suzanne Lang, and I hope we have brought something new to you today. You can hear me regularly on this station. Subscribe to our podcast at norcalpublicmedia.org. I have production assistance from Sean Knight and Mark Prell. This is a production of Northern California Public Media and Lit Radio. Thanks for listening. Visit us again. It's a novel idea.